Thank you for standing by. The conference is being recorded. You may begin.
Thanks very much. This is the September Charm Telecon. Our speaker today is Chris Peronicus. Chris is from the Applied Physics Laboratory at Johns Hopkins University in Laurel, Maryland. And he's a co-I on MIMI, which is the magnetospheric imaging instrument on Cassini. And before that, he worked on Voyager and Galileo. And his particular interest tends to be with icy satellites and magnetospheres. And magnetospheric interaction with the icy satellites is what he's going to be talking about today. Chris deserves extra credit because he was in Rome last week. Instead of seeing the sights in Rome, he was working on his charm telecon in his hotel room. So I think, like I said, he really deserves extra credit. He's hosting a workshop at JPL next month in association with the Cassini Project Science Group meeting, and he's arranging for speakers on various topics of satellite magnetospheric interaction. And I thought it would be appropriate for him to put together a charm telecon on that topic, so that's what he's going to be talking about today. And with that, Chris?
Okay, so I'm on to slide one, obviously. I'm going to be talking about magnetospheres in a lot of detail. So if you're not familiar with all that entails, I'm going to go through it pretty slowly, and the interaction of those objects with the satellites of Jupiter and Saturn. And one reason I wanted to include Jupiter is just because there's some interesting things about the Jovian satellites, and I sort of wanted to be able to flip back and forth between the two planets. So a lot of my material is from some of the books in my references at the end, and I also wanted to mention there's a Saturn book called Saturn from Cassini-Huygens. It's a 2009 Springer book that's also very useful. One reason I like these books better than trying to track down a research article is the material is sort of processed over, you know. Some of the most important material that's in the research articles is sort of summarized in the book chapters. So I think those were a really good reference, and everything I say today will pretty much be from those sources. So slide two on the outline, I'm going to first just sort of talk about what a magnetosphere is, and then I'm going to remind everyone ourselves about the satellites of Saturn, since that will be the focus. Then I'm going to talk about how the satellites of the planets impact the magnetosphere, and I'm sort of doing this from the point of view of the data. So what we have found by actually going there, looking at the planets remotely from the Hubble. So what kind of things have we actually seen in the data? So this is a little bit different from someone who might do modeling, you know, of a satellite atmosphere, and be saying, here's a model I put together with all the chemistry of the atmosphere. And I turn these knobs, and this is what I think the interaction looks like. So that's not what I'm going to be coming from. I'm going to really be saying, you know, we went there, we measured this, what does it mean? And after, that's going to be the bulk of my presentation. But before I finish, I'm going to talk about magnetospheres, what the magnetospheres do to the satellites, so what kind of magnetospheric weathering occurs on the satellite surfaces. We are currently interested, people who work on Cassini and have worked on Galileo, and also people who study these things remotely. Okay, so on the next slide, slide three, this is a very early sketch of magnetic field lines associated with the Earth. So if you can imagine a bar magnet inside the Earth pointing down, so the North Pole is in the southern hemisphere of the Earth. So field lines are coming out, and they sort of want to form on the left-hand side what you usually think of as the bar magnet. So there's closed magnetic field lines that are circling out of the magnet in the Earth back on themselves. And then on the right-hand side, you sort of see a more realistic bar magnet in the solar wind, and the field lines are no longer able to close on themselves anymore. They're sort of being stretched out by a variety of processes. One of these processes, if you could see this sort of dark line on the x-axis, starting at about 10 R sub e, 10 Earth radii, and that is the current flowing toward us. And whenever you have magnetic field lines either changing strength or direction, there has to be current sort of intermediating, if that's a word, that process. So this is a kind of a really crude sketch of what the magnetic field of a planet would look like. And if we go to slide four, this is a slide showing these magnetic field regions for a whole bunch of objects in the solar system. So you can start at the middle one on the left, and this is the magnetic field of Ganymede. Right above it is the magnetic field of Mercury. And one thing you might notice is that Ganymede is larger than Mercury, and its magnetosphere is larger than Mercury's magnetosphere. And this was something that was discovered with the Galileo mission. This isn't something we knew from remote observations. Then you can sort of see, if you follow these sort of blue shaded areas, you can see how each magnetosphere fits in successively with the next one. So you can see Mercury's is quite a bit smaller than the Earth. That's quite a bit smaller than these, you know, the two outermost planets. And those are smaller than the largest one, which is Jupiter, and Saturn's is a bit smaller than that. And you can see the Sun, that black circle in the lower corner, and that's about how big the Sun is on the sky. And people often talk about how if Jupiter's magnetosphere were visible, it would be the largest object in the sky. And you can see that pretty well on this slide. Is everybody good with that so far? Okay, so these other sort of lines to the left of each of the magnetospheres, that's the bow shock. So that's the first boundary that the solar wind, the plasma falling from the Sun, would encounter. That sort of indicates there's some kind of obstacle coming up. The outermost boundary of the magnetosphere that the solar wind comes in contact with. And you can see Mercury's bow shock is very close to the body, and that's because the solar wind, you know, is coming off from the right. It's very strong. It's a weak magnetic field, so it's not able to sort of fend off the solar wind very well. So that one is, you know, a couple of body radii, maybe, but where you get to the Jupiter bow shock is more 100 Jovian radii in front of the planet. So this is a much bigger magnetosphere. It's more powerful magnetically, and it's holding off a weaker solar wind pressure because now it's already gotten to 5 AU, and it's weakened quite a bit, and Jupiter is a powerful magnet. So that's sort of where these structures are forming some kind of equilibrium in the impacting solar wind between their own pressure and internal magnetization pressure and the impinging solar wind magnetic field and pressure. Okay, so within these structures, now we're on slide 5, we trap charged particles. I tried to say some words to make this not sound as mysterious as it could be. So the trapping in these magnetic fields is basically just due to the fourth equation, F equals ma. Now I'm going to skip the next bullet and go to the one after that. If you wanted to understand how a charged particle would be, say, trapped on a closed magnetic field line, you can take the simple equation and expand the magnetic field around the position of the center of the particle's motion, the so-called guiding center, plus the gyro motion. I'll explain what that is in a second. And then you can basically take F equals ma and show that when the particles are moving up and down the field lines, as they approach the stronger magnet or the planet, they are reflected. So you're able to figure out that the acceleration along the magnetic field line actually gets turned around when you move up toward the source of the magnet. And that's called, you know, magnetic bottle or trapping of particles, which is what gives a rise at the Earth to the Van Allen radiation belts, which I'm sure you're all familiar with. So there's this idea that you have these sort of stable energetic particles, charged particles like protons and electrons, that are just trapped by the bottle feature of the magnetic field so close to the planet. Then when you get further away, where you don't have that bottle feature as much, the field lines don't have those foot points on the magnet, you sort of lose that trapping. And you know, obviously like the Van Allen radiation belts, they don't go on forever. They're trapped in a few body radii altitudes of the Earth, and then after that, the plasma and the particles are much weaker. Okay, the only other thing I want to return to is this one bullet. So how would you describe, if someone gave you the magnetic field, how would you describe the magnetic field line? And that is this simple equation. So you take a unit of field line and you cross it with the magnetic field at that particular point, and you set that equal to zero, and that's how you trace out these magnetic field lines that I'm showing you. Okay, so slide 6. So what does it look like as a practical matter? On the right, you can see an electron that is trapped on a magnetic field line that's spiraling around. That's one of its three principal motions, is this gyro motion. And it's also moving up and down in latitude, and its third motion, if you look on the left, is this sort of motion around the planet, and longitude. So those are the three motions of these trapped particles. And then back on the right, you see that the figure shows some trapped ions, positively charged, particles. They have a bigger gyro radius, and they move in sequence the same way they circle around the field and move up and down, and then they also drift in longitude around the planet. And I guess I wanted to mention that what we call ions in space physics magnetospheres always means positively charged particles, but that's not a term that's regular and standard usage for most people. The other thing about this figure is it shows some ions coming down a field line and hitting, some of them hitting the surface of Europa, and you can see there's sort of this little fountain of things coming off. And that's the process called sputtering, where you take a very energetic particle and you hit the surface of ice, and it deposits a lot of energy very quickly and then gives enough energy to the neutrals in the material that they get knocked off into the atmosphere. Or some of them return back right away, and some of them actually escape the gravity of the body. So you might, in the literature, hear the term sputter-induced atmosphere. And that's because these very energetic particles are hitting the ice and just kicking neutrals off. If you look at the electron, it's not doing sputtering. What the electron is doing is just exciting an O2 molecule that's in the atmosphere. So these things might be coming through the atmosphere. They might give energy to the molecules in the atmosphere and send one of the bond electrons to a higher excited state, and then that might, when excited state comes back to the ground, give it off as a photon. So you can tell that if you're looking at the photons coming off a cloud of neutrals, you might be able to tell that there's an electron process going on, putting energy into the neutrals. So now I'm going to talk about what a magnetosphere is in a bit more detail, but you now have the basics, that you have a bar magnet and you have these trapped particles. So now we're going to skip to slide 8. The next three slides were all slides I downloaded from the web, so I didn't attribute them specifically in my notes at the end, and I'll tell you how you can see these kind and more images on the web and how you can find their source material. And I found it useful to sort of go back to try and figure out why this particular person put this picture and emphasized it the way they did. The first one shows on the bottom this concept I've been talking about bar magnet embedded in the Earth. And again, you know, this one you could, it really looks like a bar magnet that we all learned about when we were studying physics. The field lines are coming out from the North Pole and the Southern Hemisphere, and they're wrapping around back to the South Pole. And then what this person has done is they've added solar wind to make the top panel. And again, they're showing how the field lines that sort of were coming straight out of the poles are getting swept back toward the right of the picture, some sort of magnetotail configuration. So the ones that are on the front side that are first encountering the solar wind get pushed in a little. You could see that there's sort of a more rounded one. The outer one on the left side is getting pushed to that gold one that's a little more compressed, whereas the ones that are coming out of the poles are getting swept all the way back. And then as you get closer to the low latitude region on the midnight or the right side, you can see how they're stretched. And there's a population drawn in here, the plasma sheet. There's a dense plasma. Above that, there's this magnetic field that's stretched out. This is a sort of low region that's around the plasma sheet area. Figure 9 is a sketch of the same thing we looked at, but it has drawn in a lot of the currents that flow around the magnetosphere. So like I said, anytime there's a change in magnetic configuration, there's a current flowing on the boundary. So for example, there's a current here all the way on the left called the magnetopause current. What is the magnetopause? What the magnetopause does as it divides the predominantly terrestrial plasma from the solar wind plasma. And because the Earth's magnetic field is pointing in one direction and the magnetopause and the solar wind and plasma magnetic fields are pointing in the other direction, there's a current flowing on the front of the boundary. And the last image of the magnetosphere, this is slide 10. This is the one just like I like because I gave the different regions. So it showed you clearly where things are. Like we have the Earth in the center, and then if you look carefully, there's the ionosphere of the Earth. That's what they call the plasmasphere. So there's this region of plasma. This is just above the ionosphere. And again, you can see all the currents and this lobe that I talked about. the magnetospheric lobe, and a whole bunch of other structures that are indicated here, like the plasma mantle. So that's yet another transition region where you, again, all these regions are just defining different types of plasmas and magnetic fields that are trapped in this kind of structure. In these kind of structures, there's always a question of what is carrying the current. For example, are there enough electrons so that a current can flow from point X to point Y? And sometimes there are. And you develop a huge potential drop across that wire just because you don't have enough current carriers like you do in a wire. Okay, so that's the end of the sort of sketches of magnetosphere. Okay, so let's move on to slide 11. This is a slide I took from an earlier CHARM telecon. I believe the actual source of the image is Dave Seal at JPL. So basically on top you can see the relative sizes of the Saturnian satellites. Titan's the largest. But it's not really, it's hard to see which is the largest, but Titan is. Then there's a bunch of smaller ones, inner ones like Rhea, that's about the third of the size of Titan. On the bottom is sort of where things are based on radial distance, so Saturn obviously is here on the left. And you have the main rings, and then you see there's five or seven of the larger inner satellites from Janus to Rhea. Enceladus, of course, is also in the news a lot because of the vents from the South Pole. And you could sort of see a faint ring associated with Enceladus. That's probably the grains that are coming out of these South Polar vents, and they form a very extended, diffuse ring that approximately begins at Enceladus' orbit. And it's hard to see here, but I think it goes out quite a ways. And then also drawn here is this kind of interesting, these are closest approach distances of the three spacecraft, obviously before Cassini, Pioneer 11, Voyager 1 and 2, and then there were all flyby missions. They were all flyby missions, and they all had one chance to come close to the planet. And so those are marked by these gold arrows. So you could see which one sort of got inside Mimas' orbit near the main rings. And Cassini also had a closest approach when it was captured by Saturn, but of course it's an orbiter, and so there's many more chances to pass through this region. Okay, I think that's all I wanted to say about the satellites, just sort of where they are. And since we're talking today about satellite-magnetosphere interactions, we're mostly going to be focused on this group here from the bottom, from Dione and Rhea inward, because once you get to Titan, you sometimes actually pass outside the magnetopause on the day side, because Titan is already at 20 Saturn radii. So that's about approximately where the magnetopause is on the day side. So Titan could actually go in and out, and the other ones are even farther out than that in their orbits. The other thing is they're all fairly equatorial orbits. Okay, now I'm going to move on so that you all have the basic background. I'm going to move on to how those satellites interact with the magnetospheres. Now I'm on to slide 13, which is an image, a UV image of the aurora of Jupiter. And what you can see in this image is if you start at this sort of pole, there's a polar emission that's kind of patchy, and then there's what is called a main oval. It's not exactly an oval. It has kind of funny breaks in it. And then you can see that there are three footprints. One's Io, that's the inner volcanic moon of Jupiter. Europa is the next moon out. And Ganymede is the heavily magnetized moon that's even further out than Europa. You can see that since we're mapping to the aurora, they go in reverse order. So Ganymede would be closest to the pole. This is sort of interesting. It was interesting to me when we started looking at these images, because it wasn't clear that these satellites were not just inert bodies, and that we were wondering how does a rock in a magnetosphere communicate its presence so far away as the planet's surface in the polar region. And prior to Galileo, very little was known about Europa and Ganymede footprints. And one thing that they helped do is sort of help figure out whether where the other auroral emissions, like the main oval, are mapping to. You know, if you map backwards along these magnetic field lines, we are looking at where they map to in space, in radial distance from the planet. So since we know where Europa and Ganymede are physically, we know that, for example, the main oval has to map further out. the source of the main oval has to map further out than Ganymede's orbital distance, which is about 15 Jovian radii. So that was actually very helpful, just in terms of what powers the aurora and where it actually maps to in the magnetosphere. So slide 14 is a figure that we're attempting to understand, and when I say we, I mean the whole magnetosphere community, not me personally. We're attempting to understand why these bodies, especially if they weren't magnetized, how they could be communicating their presence all the way to the planet surface in the polar region. And what this particular sketch shows is how the flowing plasma, which is that U, that's the flowing plasma on the left, is encountering, in this case, Io, which is the circle, and the magnetic field of Jupiter is draping around it. Those are the B field lines pointing straight down. And that's how that interaction would drive a system of currents, both north and south of the Moon, in these sort of cylinders, which is called the Alphane Wing. But we're really not going into a lot of detail about this. But the Alphane Wing is basically a cylinder of currents that are going up and connecting back to the planet north and south. And when we flew over this with one of the Voyagers, we actually measured a 10 to the 6th amp, a mega amp current with the magnetometer when we flew northward in latitude over Io. So we did know that there was a current system set up that was connecting to the planet. So that was, this is just one particular way of understanding the footprints. You know, there's a lot of sort of theory around all of this, how these different moons, some of them are magnetized, some of them aren't, how they're generating currents or potential drops along the field to get a signal in the aurora region. And one person that did a particularly good job of sort of understanding, pulling all this together, was Margaret Kibbleson at UCLA. She has a chapter that talks about how you would form the different types of satellite magnetosphere interactions so that you could understand, for example, which ones will have powerful interactions that reach the aurora and which ones are going to be sort of like an inert moon interaction. And slide 16, this is kind of table that people in the field were looking at. And these are the kinds of parameters that people were looking at to try and sort of figure out which of these satellite interactions would have which properties. And I'm not going to go into this in much detail, but one way of studying these interactions is by looking at the Alphane speed and the flow speed of the plasma. So in other words, let me take a step back. You're all familiar with what the Mach number is. So that's the flow speed of the plasma divided by the way the wave speed, how you communicate information through the plasma. Just like when a plane is flying through the air, there's a Mach number associated with whether it's going faster or slower than the sound speed of the local medium and whether you get a shock wave. And that's the same thing as the Alphane Mach number in a satellite magnetosphere interaction. So it's the flowing plasma going faster or slower than the speed that the waves can communicate the signal. And if there's super Alphanic interaction, that means the waves can't tell the upstream region there's an obstacle in the way and you get a shock wave. And that's what we found for the Jovian satellites, and it's actually true for the Saturnian satellite, and it's only Callisto when it's passing very close to the magnetic equator or the densest plasma where there's a super Alphanic interaction. So the normal interaction of these bodies with the magnetosphere is not to create a shock wave. So there is enough time to send a signal upstream and slow the plasma down. So the reason I was taking this little tangent is just to say that there's one way of organizing the satellite magnetosphere's interaction. So there's a shock or there isn't a shock. And other parameters on this table are other ways of doing it. For example, if the magnetic field around the body is much stronger than the pressure that would be exerted by the plasma. So, for example, at Io, in the strongest magnetic field of Jupiter, it's the most important thing. The plasma has just a weak effect on the field, whereas at Callisto, at the other end, you're in a much weaker magnetic field to the body, and the plasma effects start to become important. So, for example, on that table, the U, I think, is relative velocity, and that's the plasma velocity minus the satellite velocity divided by the Alphane speed, which is the next line, and it would tell you whether you are subalphanic or superalphanic. So now I'm going to try and move away from all the theory and that kind of stuff to showing you some pictures of satellites, again, what kind of effect they have on the magnetosphere. So now I'm on slide 17. This is the radiation model that JPL has come up with for Jupiter. So on the right is a picture of the distance from Jupiter on the x-axis and the intensity of the greater than 1 MeV electron that we measure with the spacecraft. So if you remember, the energy range is EV is the lowest, then KEV, then MeV, and GEV is sort of what cosmic rays are. So you can see that you sort of form this intense region, this radiation belt, out to 10 to 15 Jovian radii, and then you really trail off in how many particles you keep trapping. On the left-hand side is a similar picture of the radiation belt, but now this is ions, protons greater than 10 MeV. And you can just see that these belts are not as extensive as the electron ones, and that also where Io is just inward of about 6 RJ, there's sort of a notch out of the belt. And it's not that easy to see this on the picture, but at about 9.5, right at the edge of the yellow on the left, that's where Europa is. There's another change in the intensity of the belt. And what that says is that these moons are very good absorbers of these energetic protons, and they kind of sculpt the radiation belt. So this is exactly the same thing we see at Saturn. I'm going to show you a picture of that. These very energetic protons are trying to form a belt, but they do not get knocked out by the presence of satellites. Next is slide 18. This is a similar picture, but now we're back to Saturn, and we're looking at tens of MeV protons. So the top one is probably to look at. So this is basically probably the one to look at. So this is basically radial distance from Saturn and local time around the planet where, you know, it would be pointing toward the Sun. So what you see if you go from left to right is that you get more intense particle populations as you move toward the planet. So you're going from the blue color to sort of the red. So what you can notice, for example, if you look at where Mimas is, there's a whole bunch of particles eaten out right where there should be a radiation belt. That's what's called the Mimas gap. And that is just due to the presence of an inert body. When the particles hit it, they're just gone. And if you do that over time, you get these notches in the radiation belt. Another example is slide 19. Now we're looking at radial distance in the bottom in Z on the y-axis. And again, this is a lot of data from the Cassini spacecraft. What you're looking at now is that where you can see there's a notch out where Mimas is. That goes all the way up in latitude to the planet. And I think that there's even a small notch outside the red where the G-ring is. It's kind of hard to see. There's a bit of the yellow line in there too. And then at Janus, there's not as much of a deep notch out, so we don't quite go down to the background. Still, there's some particles existing at that distance, but not as intense as surrounding red colors. This is a sort of an interesting picture because those of us in the magnetosphere community are always brought up on the model, this model, that the particles get formed, that form the radiation belts are sort of being pushed in from the outside. As they get closer to the magnet, they gain energy. And eventually, they have really high energies close to the planet. So that's conservation of adiabatic invariance. That actually goes back to Einstein. One thing that's interesting about this picture is it would be hard to do that particular model. And with this data, because you can see this gap is formed at Mimas, it would be hard to push particles across that gap to build up the red color. So this was actually probably known in the Voyager days, maybe even Pioneer. I think it actually goes back to Pioneer, that the source of these trapped protons is actually not our conventional idea, that we're pushing particles in from the outside, but it's actually due to another process called CRAND. And basically what happens with CRAND is GEV cosmic rays that are accelerated very far from the Sun are impacting both Saturn and the rings, and when they do impact, they give off very energetic neutrons, more than 10 MeV neutrons. And the neutrons, you probably know, in free space don't last very long. They have a short decay life. And they become trapped protons, electrons, and neutrinos. So basically what this belt we're looking at is basically a belt that originally galactic or anomalous cosmic rays have hit Saturn and then cascaded down to trap protons. And that was the only way I think people could understand how particles could populate this region in that particular manner. So now on to slide 20, I'm going to talk a little bit about the pictures we've drawn of inert satellites and their interaction with the magnetosphere. Slide 21 shows the plasma that's trapped in the magnetosphere that's coming in from the left and flowing past the moon. And as you can see, there's a wake form. Just like any fluid passing an obstacle, you would form a wake in the downstream region. But there are some particles that just don't flow with the cold plasma in the same manner as these other particles. They're actually moving upstream, and their wake is formed on what we call the trailing hemisphere of Enceladus, the hemisphere that travels with motion. So these would be a wake that are actually in the upstream plasma region. We've looked at this for a lot of various reasons, because it's a way, for example, that we calibrate our instruments to know that if we pass, you know, in the upstream region of Enceladus, there would be energetic electrons that wouldn't be able to get through because they'd have to encounter the moon. So we play all kinds of games with these different wakes to understand our data when we fly by these satellites. And there's also an interesting paper that Paul Schenck is leading that's about to come out in Icarus, where he shows that since the electrons are moving in this sort of retrograde way, that they are weathering more heavily the leading hemispheres of the inner satellites. And he's correlated that weathering by electrons with images of the surface. So it's kind of interesting that we talk about this sort of in a theoretical way, but you actually do optical remote sensing. You can see some of the effects of these processes on the surface. The next slide, which is 22, is just another picture of what a wake would look like when a moon is absorbing some of the magnetospheric constituents of the plasma. So the y-axis here is the number, and the L value is the radial range. And then you have a longitude in the other direction. And this figure is meant to convey that if you have some particles that are coming from the outside, and a planet itself is a sink of particles, so if they were sort of following some kind of diffusive process, and you would sort of have a high density of particles far away, and then as you got in, you would basically fall off to zero. And that, in this particular picture, would give you a sort of rounded, you know, part of the sphere when you're coming inward, but instead, because the moon is actually changing shape of how the particles diffuse in and brings the shakedown very quickly, then you can see there's like an actual wake filling in right there, sort of in the middle of the picture. And the next slide, 23, is a look into these wakes to see if the particles were absorbed the way we think. And the top left panel, you can see that here's the data. The count rates are on the along the orbit of Cassini behind Enceladus. And you can see where these little notches, so there's a blue and a green in color in the wakes where the moon would have absorbed these particles. One interesting thing about this picture is panel C shows time on the x-axis and energy on the y-axis, and you can see the wake is right in the middle there. And the depth of that, what energy actually, you go from having the blue color, so the background being filled in and not absorbed by the moon, that's due to the fact that some of these electrons, the ones above 100 MeV, are going in the other direction. So for some of these particles, they've passed through the satellite and reached the spacecraft. And for other of these particles, they haven't even found out there's a satellite there, and they're coming from the other direction. So that actually, one thing we use to figure out how fast the plasma is flowing past Enceladus, just basically where that cutoff is, where you go from the dark blue color to the orange and green colors in the center of that picture. In the next slide, 24, this is another cut through the wake. Now we're doing a cut in the direction that's perpendicular to the wake. And the little black diamonds are data we took as we cut through the wake region. And the black line is a model for how the wake would fill in just by processes that can, you know, mixing of the particles near the wake and how they'd eventually fill in, like the simulation we saw. And the idea of this fill-in of the wake actually goes all the way back to Van Allen's work on the Pioneer 11 data. He was studying very similar pictures because the fill-in of these wakes tells you how fast things are being shaken in around the magnetosphere and whether it's just sort of static and, you know, rigid system where you don't fill in. You just make a hole and it stays for a long time, or whether things are shaking around enough because of the field, it's not quite so strong that you fill it in faster. So we're still continuing to study that process because it tells us how the magnetosphere is evolving and how long things really stay. That's when there are changes in the magnetosphere, how long do they last? So now I'm on to slide 25. This is a figure from a science paper that shows the events I was talking about earlier from Enceladus. So what you're looking at is Saturn, sort of there in the background. You can see the magnetic field lines in the foreground. They're passing by. They're overtaking Enceladus. And you could see that because of vents in the southern hemisphere, that these field lines are a bit hung up and they're trying to sweep across the body. So this was sort of interesting because it did sort of foreshadow the discovery of the moons that the imagers did, because they noticed there was sort of a hang up of the magnetic field lines downward south of south latitude from Enceladus. So there's that's interesting. The one thing that's interesting about this is that if you really have a completely inert body, you sort of expect the fields to just flow over it as if there were nothing there. But because there's so much gas being added, and that's becoming ionized, the magnetic field that's sort of sweeping over it is being hung up, and that's got to accelerate new plasma that's being created there to be swept up with it. So there's enough of a perturbation to the magnetic field that's flowing by that you could actually see it in the data. And the mag team from Cassini noticed pretty early on that there was something going on in this region, and they were studying for a while what could give you that signature in the data. So that those images that we're looking at had a lot to do with the idea that the moons are just inert. So there's a rock, and it's absorbing particles and interacting with the magnetosphere that way. So we do know for some of the Jovian satellites, for example, Ganymede, that they generate their own magnetic field. And on slide 27, this is a simulation of the interaction between the magnetic field that's generated by internal to Ganymede and the flowing plasma of the Jovian system as it flows past the body. So on the left-hand side, you can see the magnetic field being distorted from a dipole again, from a simple bar magnet being pushed down in the direction of flow in the Jovian system. And on the right-hand side, this is the flow speed, these different colors. And you can see as you approach the body, you see this axis here, the color bar, that you're slowing down the flow quite a bit. So you're slowing down the plasma as you approach Ganymede. And then in the region above the pole, this is the black region, you slowed the flow down very significantly over Ganymede's polar caps due to the magnetic interaction between Ganymede's own magnetic field and the magnetic field of Jupiter. And that's one thing we did measure when we flew through the region with Galileo, that the flow speed over Ganymede, it really seems like it stopped. The plasma's really not flowing. And this, I think the simulation captures it very well. Okay. That was just some examples, a handful of examples of what kinds of effects in the magnetosphere we see that tells us there are satellites there and they have different kinds of electromagnetic properties and vents and things like that. And I just wanted to finish by looking at the opposite process, which is what happens to the surfaces of satellites due to the fact they're located in these magnetospheres. So now I'm on to slide 29. This is a figure from Bob Johnson, who talked about this kind of weathering of the surfaces by charged particles that are trapped in the Jovian magnetosphere. So you can see on the right-hand side, there are electrons and protons entering into the surface very deeply. On the left-hand side, there's sodium and sulfur entering the topmost portion of the ice of the surface. And the reason he was interested in some of these processes is, like, why is neutral sodium coming out if sodium ions are going in? Because some of the imaging, even from Earth, that we do look at various species, for example, sodium, and we try and figure out why the rates or the surface systems themselves are giving us those particular neutrals or ions when we image them remotely. So he was interested in this whole process of how you are putting in these chemicals and what's happening in the ice, what chemical reactions are happening in the ice, and again, what's coming out, and we can image that remotely. The other reason I'm interested in this process is because when we look at these surfaces with different wavelengths of the UV, IR, visible, we're always trying to figure out what chemicals are present below the ice. And we're trying to connect that with, for example, whether the processes in geology are bringing chemicals to the very near surface that we could observe optically, and if those chemicals that we're bringing from the interior, what they're telling us about the body themselves. My spin on that subject has been, if you're adding some of the chemicals just because they come from the outside, a particular thing we're looking at might have nothing to do with the body. It might just really be a pure ice surface that's been processed chemically by constituents that are in the magnetosphere. So, for example, we know that the volcano is on Io, or sources of SO2 gas, and then sulfur is therefore going into all the surfaces of the Jovian satellites. And then it's making chemicals, for example, H2SO4 at the ice. Then when we find H2SO4 in the ice, therefore we might say it's not really, has nothing to do with the chemistry of the body, but it might just be the chemistry of the surface due to things that are coming in. The question is, what do we see in the images of the surface? And slide 30 is an image of Ganymede. It's actually a color ratio where we are, where the equatorial or the low latitude surface is very dark in this particular color ratio, and the polar caps are bright. And what this particular figure was to show was that the Ganymede magnet is basically closed. Those closed field lines of the magnet are between the three color lines in the north and the three color lines in the south. Those are all the closed Ganymede field lines that connect only to the Ganymede magnet, whereas the ones in the north and south are field lines that have one footprint on the Ganymede magnets and the other on the Jovian magnet. So these regions in the north and the south are actually open to the magnetospheres of Jupiter. And what we find is the weathering of the surface from the Jovian magnetosphere is much different than the weathering that's on these closed field lines in the equator, which is, there's much less flux on them. So this was sort of an indication that the Jovian magnetosphere really is weathering the surface to be much brighter. So you might ask, what does that mean? It means that we're actually It means that things that we're actually looking at when we look at the surface are the products of charged particles, not the things that are happening because of the geology. So the reason that it's interesting is, again, because when we're looking at these surfaces, we're always imagining that there's just geology driving everything. And, you know, bringing ice at various ages to the surface, and that's changing because of craters and other impacts. But this figure shows that the magnetospheric weathering is actually very important. The next slide was some work that I did on Europa, and we were trying to look at how magnetospheric impact on Europa on different hemispheres might have to do with what we're detecting optically. So this figure shows how much electron energy is going into Europa's surface. That's the red. The red contours and this trailing hemisphere of Europa. So it's being heavily weathered by energetic electrons. And the next slide, slide 32, this is again showing the trailing hemisphere of Europa. That's the center of the red bullseye. But here we're looking at the concentration of hydrated SO2 in the surface that was detected in the IR. We get these bullseyes at various places in the solar system. This particular one has nothing to do with the concentration of H2SO4, and we're wondering whether it had anything to do with the weathering or that something was really about the interior of Europa. So the reason we put together the electron model is because there's a lot of different weathering of the surface, but nothing we knew of except for electrons that gives us this bullseye. And in slide 33, you can see the comparison of the electron energy and then the bullseye. And you know, you might say, well, what's so special about electrons? Well, things like photons weather the surface much more evenly, so wouldn't expect there to be a particular place on the surface that you'd have more weathering than less, whereas the electrons, we know that's true. Okay, I'm on my conclusion slide now, so the main conclusion is that I hope I gave you some examples of how we're using data and modeling to understand the mutual influence of satellites and magnetospheres. And then some specific examples are the one that we just looked at about Europa. Europa's surface, like many of the surfaces in the solar system, may be heavily weathered by different processes coming from the outside. And on the other hand, there's evidence that things we're looking at on the surfaces of the satellites are also due to androgenic processes and things that are turning over on the inside and getting brought to the surface. Another example of the satellites are of how important the satellites are to the magnetospheres. There is the Io volcano story, where Io is giving off a lot of gas that's getting swept up into the Jovian magnetosphere, and that's driving a current system into the aurora. Again, we can image optically, remotely. Finally, the Enceladus plumes, which we saw with the Cassini ISS camera, were studied even before that, even before we saw them, by perturbations to the magnetic field that were detected by the Cassini magnetometer as it flew past.